Calling all lovers of mystery and fans of a good story. If you haven't already heard me talk about June's journey, you're in for a treat. It's time to don your detective hat in this free hidden object mobile game that delves into the captivating journey of June Parker, a self-proclaimed detective on a quest to unravel the mystery surrounding her sister's untimely death. In June's journey, you get to play as June, deciphering clues and unveiling secret plots within thousands of beautifully illustrated scenes. And did I mention it's set in the glitzy 1920s? New chapters are added weekly, so you will never run out of new thrills to uncover, and you can also personalize and decorate your very own Orchid Island where the story takes place. How sharp are your detective skills? Find out when you download June's Journey on your Android or iOS device, or play online via Facebook Games. Your detective journey awaits.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 8 of Beyond the Eclipse. My name is Aethor, and I'm the voice of Squash and Gref. And with me, I have Volanda.
Hello.
Volanda is the DM of The Lucky Die, as you most likely know. I'm not sure how
I
you ended up here not knowing
you
that.
Should know at this point. I speak probably 50% of the time.
You're a pretty dominant voice, a pretty prominent voice.
I am the world. The world speaks through me. I guess that's why. So yeah, episode 8. Doing episode 8 of Discora.
Yeah. Episode 8 is called The Key to Success.
It's Keys to Success, I think.
Oh, I may have misspelled it when I was writing it out. And I want to start the episode by reading the opening spiel by V, which I think I forgot last episode.
Yes, she did, but I hate it.
So, episode 8. Welcome back, companions, to the Lucky Die. Previously, Balance gets help from a friend, Ralzhak broke the leg of a spider hitting him, and Sultana became a dwarven shotput.
Shotput.
Shotput? Shotput, what's that?
A shotput is a small metal ball that you lob forward, and it's an Olympic sport.
Okay, I get it. Yeah. After seeing visions of black and white being shattered, the group found themselves enveloped in a soft blue light. What did these strange visions mean? What will this strange blue light herald? And is today the day to reassemble the light and save the future? Reassemble the light and save the future. I guess we're about to find out. Welcome back to the Lucky Die.
All right, I need to address something right now. What the fuck is that voice?
Oh, that's my soft-spoken British voice. This is my fake V voice.
That's just terrible. I sound nothing like that.
Well, how would you know? We all sound different to ourselves. Heard a recording of yourself.
I never heard a recording of myself. No, I don't QC this on nothing. No.
Never, ever. Never, have you ever.
You sound like Squash's like ancient grandma, like trying to read Squash's story. Like, oh, and so we reassemble the light. I'm like, God fucking damn it. Sorry. That was an intro. Yep.
Yep. At the end of the last episode, we had a premonition that was pretty solid. Like, set up a a good number of things coming up. So now we are on to... We're on to episode 8, where I think the starting of the episode is them basically just pushing open the door and walking in.
Pretty much. They're kind of in that, like, really entrance doorway. Like, I personally imagine, like, a huge vault door, like, to a bank vault. And it's massive and big, and they have to push it open or pull it open, and then they're inside, and then it closes behind them. So that's what I imagine when they're in there. But, yeah, the majority of this episode is, at least the start of this episode, is them deciding to walk inside.
Yes, there's a little bit of unsureness in the group.
Yeah. You know,
some people are more afraid for their lives. Other people just want to go home. Uh-huh. They just want to leave.
I think they sound like the same person. I think we're both talking about Raoul. Both of those statements.
Yes. I absolutely adore how skittish Raoul is in these early episodes.
Too.
He just wants to go home.
Aww.
But unfortunately for Raoul, he has two players who are not going to walk away from the plot with him.
Was the phrase that Neil started using was, Raoul started using was the brave adventurers, and I started using that everywhere. And I noticed that Neil had also started putting that into the episode descriptions at this point. The brave adventurers do this, the brave adventurers and Raoul do that. So the running gag for like the first like 30 episode descriptions is like the adventurers. So yeah, the adventurers and Raoul. So that's
the brave adventurers and Raoul.
Yeah.
Oh, that's so mean. I love it.
Well, Neil started. Yes. It wasn't my fault.
So they walk in there and. They get introduced to a scene. Mm-hmm. They have a wall with a carving on it. They have a fountain, and they have two spooky statues. But they don't look statuesque, really. They look kind of real.
Yeah, yeah. So it's like a really big antechamber, and I wanted it to feel like. I don't go to church often. I went to church a couple of times as a kid, and then they were like, nah, it's not for me. And there were like pews everywhere, and there was all these like pretty statues around, and like there were these carvings in the wall. And I wanted it to be like that, but this is D&D, so I didn't want there to be like an official altar at the end, because also it didn't fit with the context of what this area is. I was like, fuck it, I'll stick a 10-foot skeleton and a bear. Sounds great.
Zombie bear, I guess.
Undead bears, yeah.
We have a weird little interaction between Casey and Balance. Casey and Balance.
Sultana
Balance
and Balance.
Sultana, yep. Or Arch and Casey. where Casey says something along the lines that they want to steal the bear's coat. And Raoul says something, I think, was, I'm just afraid it's going to come alive. And Casey replies, I ain't afraid of no bear. And Balas says...
It would be undead at this point. I ain't afraid of no undead bear.
I'm so sad. Nobody said, what if it was a ghost? Because that would have finished the fucking joke. I genuinely listened to it. And I was like...
See, this is why we needed the fourth when we started, because you could have added that in.
No, I'm much more clever afterwards. I listened back to some of the episodes.
That's
and I'm like,
true.
Why didn't I say this? Why didn't I say that?
Yeah,
but alas, you're very much in your head when you're playing.
Yeah, very much so. But I'm gonna say, like, Casey, Arch, Neil, they're just on effing point this episode. I think this is the beginning of a new recording session, and everyone was just on one, and it was great.
Everybody's fresh. You can tell that everybody is fresh.
It's that fresh recording, fresh game energy to it, and they're just so on point, and it's so funny. This was a good.
And then they proceed to like inspect the altar and the pews and things around. And Casey rolls a pretty good roll on their religion check.
Yes.
Which means that you got to info dump a bunch of a tempest.
Yeah. So I went back to my notes on this because my notes on this section, on this and episode 9, because they're so very closely related. And because things in this room and the things for the trials coming up for them before they even get to the mirror room, they're so... linked together. So we have, I managed to do info dump on one of the gods, Tempest. Mm-hmm. Tempest is a war god. Their symbol is a flaming sword. So I knew that that the Tempest would have a key somewhere in this room, and it had to be related to like something in that domain. I knew that there was going to be a room pass guardian, or I just called him Skeleton King in my notes as I read back, and damn, I wish I'd done that.
That would have been way better than guardian.
Well,
Skeleton King.
I also have a thing about that, but we'll come back when we get to it.
We need to make a definitive edition of the Lucky Die.
No.
The director's edition.
No,
where we
this
rename
is the director's edition. So I knew that there had to be a god, that god would have a key, that key would relate to a room, that room would relate to a task, and that task would relate to a coin. So all these like 5 points had to be very carefully monitored. So my notes had to be fucking spot on for this. So in my notes, I literally have like skull key, desk with this kind of a trap, room with this kind of a task related to the god, and then the item that comes out of it. So I had to have it all broken up. And that's how my notes are structured for this section and the following episode. I'm just running off of 3 massive paragraphs, which just breaks down like those bits. We have in here before my prep for this was, all right, I know that there was going to be a thing. I'd already known that Savras was going to be involved in this jazz because that was important. So Savras would be involved somehow, but I couldn't make him fit into any decent tasks that weren't like, I'm going to tell you your future, boy. And I'm like, no, I can't do that. So that's why Claws and Guardian are there. They're Savras's gift to this situation. I was like, okay, I've got this. Now I need to put together the gods that were essential or a part of how Marnach and how Kells got broken into different pieces. I'm like, okay, then I want to give myself a war god because that makes sense. I want to give myself a death deity because that also makes sense. And damn it, rule of three. Fuck it. Nature, wild. Oh, even better. Wild nature. Fuck. Yes, this makes sense. So I had to figure out those 3 gods. So I ended up going with Sylvanas, which is supposed to be a male god of the elven male god of wild nature. And I'm like, fuck it. I'm making them female. Hence why one of the statues is what they are later on. We had Tempest, which is a short, angry fighter dude. And I thought works real well with Zoltana. And then we had Mirkel, which comes up quite frequently in the end. And like, I know I kind of wanted a death god to be involved specifically because I knew the stuff coming up with Ra would mean that I would need a god of death or a deity of death or a goddess of death so that I could resurrect Aemir. So I kind of needed all that together. So that's why it all got squished in. So yeah, like the notes for this are, they're pretty big paragraphs, but all of them relate to those things. And I was really happy that I managed to relay some of that information. I was never going to give it all out. I was never going to say, here are your 3 gods. Not 20 or no, because some of this would be quite obscure and they wouldn't necessarily know most of this. And then throughout the game or throughout this particular episode, kept asking different questions in different ways. I'm like, yes, I can do more info dumps.
They were very good at like poking you for information this episode. And sometimes you played balls, not always.
Yeah.
And I think they were doing pretty well. I have one question about the antechamber. Now, I was listening to this just earlier and my attention span is fickle, let's say that.
Mm-hmm.
At one point, you described a statue, I think, of a female elf holding a slain male dwarf.
Yep.
Do they interact with that again? Is that the one with the trap in it?
That's the one with one of the traps in them.
Okay.
So the short fighty dude is supposed to be Tempest, and I think the elven female was supposed to be Sylvanas, but that's not really quite how I was intending to use them, and it was kind of more supposed to be like over here on Discora. I'm remembering this now that I'm talking about it, that over here on Discora, that the major factions involved were the elves and the dwarves. Some involvement from the gnomes, some involvement from halflings and humans, but not enough to be really like noteworthy. So that's why I had an elf and a dwarf there. But she had pins in her hair, like hairpins, and they were just really sharp. Mm-hmm. And that was basically the trap there not do that.
All right, so let's go through it. They enter the room and they don't know it yet, but they're looking for keys. And as they start looking, the outside door closes.
Yep.
In the most lackluster way I've ever heard a door close, it just starts closing, and then it clicks.
Yeah.
And I was just sitting there like, was that door huge? Where's the kathump? Like,
I was impressed when I was listening back, like, oh, I didn't realize I did my own like sound effects. I'm amazing. Here you are like shitting all over it. I'm like, I was well impressed I'd done that.
I'm sorry, click and kathump have very different meanings when it comes to doors. And I may not be the Lord of the Doors, but I am going to be pedantic about this.
Uh-huh, fine, be pedantic. But that's the sound it made. Maybe, maybe Othel, it's a magic door.
Then it would have gone whoosh.
No.
And shrilly sounds.
And then click or clank, whatever sounds I made, they were good. I thought they were cool. Fuck you, Othel.
Yeah, you don't do sound effects anymore. I think probably because I mock you for them.
Yes. No, that's not the only reason. I realized that later on, like, unless it was specifically adding to a moment, I didn't necessarily want to make all the sound effects. And Neil had decided pretty early, actually from one of our former podcasts we were on, that sound effects for things like bow draws and like doors opening and like drinking, that's just too much to add in to be able to feasibly edit this in a decent amount of time. And also... Yeah, no. It can sound good if people are dedicated to it and they do it a lot, but if they kind of do it half-assed like I was making the sound effects, it doesn't sound as good. So it's more distracting.
I've heard a podcast where they do that kind of stuff more casually than some of the bigger podcasts out there. And I've always found that it's not bad. Like, just don't use the same door sound effect every time. Don't do the same
different Wilhelm scream, please. Yeah.
Yeah. But I've always enjoyed those, but I do recognize like the amount of effort that takes. Like that is making a giant bank of Foley sounds and picking and choosing and
And that all adds additionally to the editing time. So it's not also just like, I will drag and drop from here to here. Someone has to find those clips, find when they are in the episode, insert them, and then balance them into the sound mix. Because you don't want everybody having like talking on the same frequency, because that will just sound like trash in your ear. And adding in extra sound effects means a load of extra work with something like, it's 3 seconds of ka-dunk. It's not worth like the extra like maybe hour of work. Like, no.
Hour may be overestimating it, but yes, it is genuinely like finding the sound effect, plonk it in and QCing it is probably 15 minutes per sound effect. Yeah. And you don't realize it until you've done it yourself. Mm-hmm. As somebody who has like audio mix little like videos I've made and like added little sound effects and shit, you're like, this guy runs out of the room. I want to have a door slamming sound effect now. 20 minutes later, how did it take me 20 minutes to find a good door slamming?
Neil was like, nah, we're not doing that. And I'm like, I'm on board. I'm okay with that. After a while, I stopped doing sound effects. I don't know, like the nature of how we did stuff kind of changed and we were all trying to feel our way through it. Like you can hear the players trying to feel their way through it, but I am too, like massively trying to figure out like, what does this group work well with? How do I have to push them? How do I pull them? When do I just sit back and let them talk? And when do I interrupt them with plot? Because I'm bored. and I'm also at this table. we're all trying to find our feet and I can hear it, especially in like the early episodes. Probably between like episodes 1 and like 7 or 8, to be honest. I still hear us trying to find our feet. This is one of them.
Yeah. Early, there's a lot more swearing early on. I think we've all like taken a real big step on that.
I don't know. I still swear a fair bit.
You do, but in world, in characters, and yours of course depends on characters. Mm-hmm. Somebody like Bogrim is going to swear a lot more than Talus.
Oh yeah. So, I have more wholesome characters now.
I think the rest of the cast also swears a lot less.
I think so, yeah.
We were younger. We were inexperienced.
It was cool. It was cool to swear, kid. No, it's not.
We were
don't.
So edgy.
So edgelord. Anyway, we were chatting about this particular episode. You were mocking my door opening abilities.
The door closes and Neil does a constitution saving throw because he's afraid of enclosed spaces. Uh-huh. Now, I'm a big old dum-dum. Has Ral's claustrophobia been explored at all until now?
It hadn't really. It had come up when they went into the sewer, but only very lightly. Like, I think he rolls for a nosebleed or something, which was mine and Neil's code that he wanted to have his illness affect his character and have it show. So when he was like, oh, Raoul gets a nosebleed, that was my cue without him saying, I'm going to roll a con save, to keep it kind of in sync and to not necessarily immediately give away to the others that he had a sickness. So that was our code. So whenever you hear that in the early episodes, I think it's like the first 15 episodes before we actually touch on the claustrophobia for him, it is our code of like, I need to make him roll. Like that was our code until we like actually got into that was like our claustrophobia cue. So yeah, like until that we hadn't really come across it so much.
Okay, I think in my head I remember where the claustrophobia comes and when it's explained, but I'm not incorrect. It has been explored in story, right?
Kind of, but I think it was just a let's roll. I don't think it really came up. We properly really go into it. I think it's episode 13, 14, or 15, something along those lines. I think when they're traveling down the... I think the other side of 20 is where they're traveling down the river and they're sharing tales of misery and woe. Yeah. And I got to sit back for literally an entire session and do nothing other than respond to their backstory things that they were making up on the fly. I'm like, oh, Jesus Christ, this is hard, but really fun because I now get to save all my prep for another day.
All right, yeah. So we'll get to Raoul's claustrophobia when it comes up.
Yeah.
I just wanted to make sure I wasn't misremembering, and it does come up.
It does, yeah.
All right, so we have Laffian rush a desk and start rattling every single drawer that Laffian can get his hands on.
Yeah. This is one of my favorite bits because it is one of those like I'm the best, and then immediately someone rolls the opposite, and I'm like, oh.
It's heartbreaking, dude.
Roll 20 was such a dick to Arch, especially in the early days. Now, like the bonuses are much higher. It's a lot harder to fail, but that comes with having higher levels, and as you would expect. But yeah, these. So I believe that someone rolled an investigation or a perception or something, and they looked around and saw that there were three places in this room that were glowing. I hadn't intended that. That's not in my notes. I just wanted to give them a. hand when somebody said, I want information. I'm like, I don't know what the fuck to give you. They glow slightly. Nailed it.
Mm-hmm. So the glow seemed to be leading them to the keys. And the first one is in the desk. Laffian proceeds to empty out every single drawer he can find. He finds you being cheeky as you are, he gets a black key and he's like, oh, this is interesting. Puts it in the pocket and like, all right, I'm going to check out the rest of the drawers. And you're like, okay, there's nothing in them. Oh, I checked the bottom. There's nothing there. Okay, I checked the other drawer. There's nothing in it. I checked the bottom. Oh, it's a false bottom. Oh, I opened up. There's nothing in there. I could hear the like parent mode of like, stop it. You've gotten what you needed from the desk. Stop clicking on it.
Yeah, it kind of was. I think at that point, it was like, I don't want to say no to checking this out, but I don't know how many ways I can say you finished with the desk without breaking the meta of like, you've checked the desk. Yes. There's nothing in there. And even though I'd said that, I was still wanting to check. I'm like, all right, I have to do something. I just need to make it really clear. There's nothing in this desk.
I think Casey throws in a check the bottom of the false bottom to see if there's another false bottom.
Yeah, I think this is before like Inception the movie had come out. So otherwise, because I like listening back earlier, I was like, oh, why didn't someone just call that an Inception? Oh, wait, I don't think that had come out then.
I have a feeling it had, and I think it was already old at that point.
It might have been really old. It might have been that it hadn't fallen into any of our consciousness, because like saying something has been in Inception, like it was really big at the time and then disappeared, but has just creeped back into our culture now. I was like,
Then we have Casey over checking out the statue, and they find the key, but they find that it's obviously booby-trapped.
Yeah.
And that's around the same time. It was before that Raoul is kind of panicking and trying to figure out a way out, and he finds a door. And you, like, very coyly tell Raoul, like, there's no keyhole. And then Casey found another key, and I was laughing so hard inside myself because I could hear Neil, like, blood pressure go up as he's like, motherfucker, there is no keyhole. Stop finding keys and go find keyholes. Like, I can tell that's what he's thinking.
I think very entertaining. That interaction in the antechamber is probably one of my favorites from the early part of our show, because they're just having such fun, and Neil is having such fun being a chaos monster, and like, I just want to leave. Archer's having a great time just like leading the team and pushing them forward and exploring plot, and Casey's just on fucking point, and they're so fucking funny. Like, the obvious witticism sticking very strongly to Zoltana's like religious vibe that they have going at the time, and then just like, still, nah, fuck it, I'm the Lord of the Doors, I ain't scared of no undead bed. Like, Casey's just a wild force of their own. But yeah, like this little area, I'd say I had like three paragraphs. Nothing was really written much about this room other than specific objects in here and obviously Claws and Guardian. But other than that, it really wasn't a lot of prep, and I just let them go, and they seemed to have so much fun, and I enjoyed this a lot. It was just fun on the other side of the screen.
Yeah, you can definitely tell that Casey is having fun in this session.
Yes.
They're very much, like you said earlier, on point.
Yeah.
We have Balance getting two vials out of our desk.
Yes.
Are these the vials that get referenced?
Yeah,
these are the
vials. And they were put in there because they kept looking for shit. I'm like, I'm just going to give you something and I'll deal with the consequences later. Stop looking at the fucking desk.
So I have to ask, at this moment, you have been forced to give Balance two vials. You have been forced to give Arch two vials.
Well, I wasn't exactly forced, but I really wanted them to stop looking at the desk. I was going to, like, come on, no. So these vials came out of desperation. I didn't know what was in them. I was just going to figure it out later on.
Yeah, and they come in hard later on.
Yeah, they do.
How do you feel about it when you do stuff like that? You, like... You make a carefully constructed scenario that comes up later, and we start pulling out bullshit you didn't even remember you put down to try to save ourselves out of these situations. Do you get like a, God damn it, past V, why did you give them this?
Actually, rarely, because I actually say in this episode, and it still holds true even now, you guys are my plot twists. Like, I can drop as many plot twists and backstabbing and, like, you know, glorious moments and, like, hoorays and tears. Like, I can drop as many of those in much plot twisty ways as possible. You folks give that to me. So when Pass V has given you a vial, which, you know, an hour after writing it down, I carefully note in the region, grab D12s, do damage. Future V will probably have forgotten that, but the V that is at the table when Arch comes out with like the vial and throws it at people, I'm like, oh, this is genius. This is great, because it's also partly world building. And if you guys use something from that you've picked up that's overpowered or you're holding on to as a break in case of emergency, then break in case of emergency, yo, like, fucking do it. I'm all on board for that stuff. So there's been very few times where I've described a minor detail or I ad-libbed something in and I truly regret it. Like, there are very, very few of those. And there's so few I don't remember off the top of my head if there are any. I know I've had them. I know I've gone, why the fuck did I give you that? Whoa. Actually, I think it might be coming up in episode 11 or episode 10. There's very few of those where I give you stuff and I regret it. Mostly I'm like, nope, it's usually one-shot stuff or one use items and then fuck it. Like, we'll see what happens.
So we have Balance finding the vials and stealing other things. We have Zoltana finding a key and saying, fuck this, it's booby trap.
Yep.
And Balance tries to like distract Ral because Ral's freaking the fuck out. There's no keyhole. You fuckers keep finding more keys. And you hear Arch just go like, why don't you go over there and check out the carvings? There might be something there. And of course, that's the one that's like invisibly booby trapped and it fucking explodes in everybody's face.
I was dying. I was like, just through that whole bit, I hadn't decided exactly how the picture was going to work until he touched it. It was either he was going to touch it and feel something, or he'd put his arm through it, and I honestly hadn't decided. I just wrote down, picture with this stuff on is key in here. This is the trap if you don't look for it. At that moment when he put his arm through it, I'm like, there's nothing else I can do, right? Like, poor Ral.
So you have it blind the you have them all roll constitutions and see if it blinds them. Now you as the DM, now I have to pick your brain a little bit.
Sure.
You're sitting there, everybody rolls and everybody rolls poorly.
Uh-huh.
You as the DM are sitting there and you have three blind characters, two of which have dark vision, so it's a very rare occasion. Did you not get that, like, maybe one of the spiders is in here.
No.
Like, did you not get that gut feeling of like,
no,
something's gonna attack you fuckers now? I'm sorry.
No, I didn't. Like, it was just supposed to be basically just here. They're all just hindrances. If they had come into this room still pursued by spiders, they'd been well and truly fucked. If they had come in and immediately pissed off Guardian or Claws, they'd have been fucked. Like, there's those. Like, in combination with stuff, it could be really bad. Generally, just using a trap to blind or deafen and not having a potential follow-up to that is bad. But if you accidentally have a bunch of monsters all in the same place or a bunch of traps all in the same place and they all happen to go off within the space of like 6, 7, 8, 10 seconds of each other, that is some interesting cascade of shit. I think that's the phrase I'm massively cock up cascade.
Cock up cascade. Cock-up I was cascade. Trying to think of it too.
Yeah, that's a major ripoff from Yasuo Zero Punctuation. But that's basically what that is. Like, all these things in conjunction together, if they had decided to do them all at the same time, the thing that I had planned for the desk would have gone off, the thing that would have gone off with statues could have gone off. The picture could have gone off at the same time. They could have been followed in by a spider if they hadn't killed them all. Claws and Guardian could have been agitated by their like general demeanor. All of that at once, adding in blinding, would have absolutely destroyed them and they'd all be dead. But because they did that calmly and methodically and one after another, it's not so bad.
True, true. I guess that's one of the things that like gives actual plays their kind of feeling, their heart, the beating heart of the actual play. It is that moment where the players are doing shit and it like random shit just happens. It's like, oh, I'm going to touch a painting. Bam, you're blind for 1 minute. It's like, okay, but we're not in battle. I'm just going to wait a minute.
Yep.
It's like, yeah. Like, wait, am I supposed to be under attack? Like, I feel like I've missed the step. And it's something that if you saw in a TV show or a movie, you'd be like, this is bad writing.
Yeah,
this has no point.
This didn't serve a function. And I think for movies and like that kind of stuff, people expect that payoff. They expect that cock-up cascade. They expect that build. And if it doesn't do anything, it doesn't add anything. But in an actual play, it adds to paranoia, which is great. I've run a few games based on the idea that the world is out to get you, and by the time I dropped my third thing, and that was the last thing I was going to do over the course of like 4 or 5 sessions, they were seeing their own threats and their own paranoia. I'm like, this is the best thing ever. Like, I don't have to add this extra plot in, just seeing your own like paranoia in it, and I build into it. Like, I think you're 100% right on that. Is there something going to happen? Because there is that build up and you feel it. And then when nothing happens, great. But in conjunction with other stuff, that could have really hurt. I'm glad that they hadn't pissed everybody off.
So after the flask eases off, they have an argument about destroying the pews.
Oh, it's the best argument ever.
it's so dumb. It is so dumb. And then the Guardian speaks up.
Yeah.
Was there a specific trigger for the Guardian, or was it just whenever you get bored of the scene?
It was mostly when they had gotten to most of the stuff. So that's when Guardian was going to activate, or if anyone got really into Guardian's face, or if they'd like, you know, started touching the bear.
He's trying to steal his pelt.
Yeah, trying to steal the pelt, the bear, trying to steal the bear. Which is a question for purchasing later on, apparently. So I just had that there. I had them being able to be activated for any number of reasons. And at this point, they'd done most of the stuff, and I wanted them to be able to start figuring out what these keys are for and why they should find all of them.
Yeah. And at this point, they're explaining to them that the keys make the future tasks easier.
Yeah.
Do we want to go into that now, or do we want to leave that for next episode?
Nope, that's totally fine. So my idea with the reason they had to have the keys is to open the door so that they could get and do all the things. By having the keys, it meant that those rooms, when they turned into the functional rooms, would be available to them. If they didn't have the key, the things like the armory wouldn't be available, the meditation room / temple rooms wouldn't be available, the barracks wouldn't be available. I wanted that if they had those keys, they'd have those facilities. If they went in with no keys, they'd open the door and then they'd still have to do the task because they need the coin for it. But if they didn't have the key, they wouldn't have access to the facilities afterwards. And it would be a very empty temple underneath, and that wouldn't be the focus of where we are. Like it's kind of become their official unofficial headquarters, I guess, other than the Shik Shack, which is the official headquarters. So if they didn't have that, this place wouldn't be a hub. And I'd intended it to be a hub. And if they didn't pick up the keys and they didn't give them to Guardian when Guardian asked for them, then they wouldn't have access to them. So that's what the keys are for.
They never really seemed to consider the option of moving forward without the keys. I'm assuming that was like a sweat off your brow, like, oh, phew, like, I had all these fun things planned for you guys.
Like, they still have to do the task. So I'm like, my prep time wasn't at all destroyed. It was never going to be lost. But it was like, oh, okay, so, you know, if they don't do it, then fine. They just don't have access to these things and they'd have to make trips to the surface more often. So, or just not ever come back down here.
Or, yeah, maybe leave the temple alone, you know?
Yeah, the temple would have been as it is, and Guardian and Claws would still be down there doing their thing and protecting the artifacts. Like, yeah.
Now, we have Guardian speak up. Is this the first time we hear your voice being gargled? No, we have Monarch.
There's a minor effect on Monarch. But this is the first time that Neil went whole hog on fucking with my voice. And it's a much better voice than Guardian, but because I don't listen back to my raw files, my local recordings, I don't know what Guardian sounds like anymore.
Yeah.
I have no idea. However, Claws, I still know, because Claws is just a bear, and I have a very stable bear-related soundtrack in my brain. So I'm able to replicate Claws' like groans and cries, so it's really easy. But Guardian's really tough, and so is Spectre, because they were so heavily modulated, I have no idea where they started. And I could just go back and listen to the raw file, but that's such a mess of stuff. I'm like, I don't want to do that, so... But yeah, this is the first time it's like heavily done, and I was laughing so hard when I'd heard what he'd done to Guardian and to Claws. I was dying. That was great.
It reminds me of the voice actor for Gurr from Invader Sim. Apparently people make comments about the first season and the second season that the voice sounds completely different.
Yeah.
And they thought they replaced him and didn't actually change him in the credits. And it turned out, no, he had listened and watched the entire first season and forgotten the voice he did. And the entire modulation, he started emulating it. So his voice got even higher and weirder.
That's hilarious.
So I'm imagining that with you and Guardians.
Yeah, that happens with a couple of characters, actually, especially ones that are heavily modulated. Guardian, I struggle a lot with Spectre. I have no idea what his original voice sounds like, and I don't even know if I get anywhere close to it these days. They're hard ones for me to do. Characters that we haven't met in a long time, or like one-off incidental characters, I don't, for example, remember what Squash's parents sound like. And we recorded episodes about them fairly recently, and we recorded episodes about them fairly recently before that too, and I don't remember. I don't honestly remember what they sound like.
It wouldn't be human to remember them all. Like, let's just be very fair.
Yeah.
We have probably somewhere in the ballpark of 100 speaking NPCs in this world.
Yes. Looking through the Patreon name list, I've used 98. And I know that two of those are non-speaking character roles.
Okay. We have... speaking of names, we have Balance asking the Guardian, hey, what's your name? The Guardian like, I don't even remember, but buddy, stop asking me difficult questions. I ain't got time for this. Were you in that moment like, shit?
Yes. I'm not gonna lie. I didn't have a name written down. I just had Skeleton King. And I'd gotten used to kind of this point of them never asking who anyone is called. And that is a pretty traditional role-playing thing, is you just forget to ask somebody their name. You like, oi, give me this information. Oh, wait, what was your name again? We do that a lot. And that's also not supernatural. But also when you meet someone for the first time, you often just introduce yourself. But often folks don't. We kind of forget, especially in RPGs. So it was a case of, Guardian never had a name. Guardian's name was down to Skeleton King. And that's the name I have down there. And when I was running it, I forgot to look at my notes. So I forgot to say Skeleton King. I just said, crap, Guardian. Nailed it, me. And then Claws. Claws was always Claws. Claws is always in my notes, Claws.
That's simple enough. Yeah. All I can say is release the Skeleton King cut. So we have Guardian speak up, he explains the situation, give me the keys and I'll make your tasks a little bit easier. Or that will simplify your...
It will make your future tasks easier, I wasn't actually referring to the ones that immediately came afterwards.
Yeah, and we have Klaus grunt two or three times.
Oh, I love Klaus.
But then we proceed to just find the, like, they just rip the key out of the statue eventually.
the solution as you can hear- to that is genuinely genius. I'm like, fuck.
They did good.
It was genuinely good. I'm like, all right, I'm on this. Like, I know deck save, you can't actually like negate the damage down at all, but like, fuck it. This is genuinely genius. I love it. That was a good solve. I'm glad they went back to get it. Like, it's good.
Yeah. You have the entire room bully balance for getting fucked a little bit.
Yeah.
No bully balance.
Actually, I want to talk about something that came up in the when I was looking through the desk. A really low investigation role.
Yes.
Now, there are kind of two different ways of approaching low roles, especially investigation roles or like insight roles or perception roles. One is a low role means you don't know anything, you're not sure. And the other way to approach it is the DM can decide what you know at that level. Like, a one could mean that I outright lie to you and tell you false information. And the other side of that is like, you have no idea. This is what you suspect, but your character also knows you don't know. I don't mind if it's below 10 GMs lying to me. I have no problem with that whatsoever. But that's not how our table wanted to run. Our table specifically did not want to have nat ones on combat to be dropping weapons and anything that leaves you in a bad situation, because that sucks. And why would you do that once every 20 times? Drop your goddamn sword. I don't know, guys. You strike a lot. I don't mind either, to be honest. And then we also had the, like if we don't meet the DC, we don't get lied to, which makes it difficult when you're doing things like insight checks, when you're having characters deliberately lie to other characters, because if they roll low, they will almost always assume that, like, if they're telling the truth, it's an easy check. But if they're not telling the truth, it's a hard check. And if I didn't meet the DC, it means that they were lying. So there is a little bit of meta balance there. This was one example of where a low roll meant I couldn't lie about stuff. I couldn't give false information. So I gave something real basic. Sorry, I saw that in my notes before we started moving on to the other stuff.
I actually would love to touch down on this, because this is something that I've had extensive conversations and I've tried to do it, but it's such extra work that I've never been able to like fully settle on it. I have always, in the back of my head, wanted perception, insight, investigation roles where the player doesn't really know if they succeeded or failed until you tell them.
Mm-hmm.
And even if you tell them, it's not clear if they've succeeded or failed. I've always wanted those roles to be done behind the DM screen. And some people may find that incredibly insane or like intrusive, I guess.
Yeah.
I'm taking the role away from the player.
Yeah, it takes a little bit of agency away from the player. I think that's definitely something that if you're playing with people and you have an ability to talk to them properly, either like a good session zero or just like it becomes house rules, like you could just say, hey, I want to roll a perception roll. And the GM is like, okay, I'm going to roll behind the screen. And then you agree that that's what happens. Because obviously you know your perception, but I can't tell you what the role was, otherwise you know whether you passed or failed. I think that's definitely, it comes down to each table's preference. And I'm kind of a fan of like nat ones fucking you over. Like that's just my personal fan. If you are going to run with nat 20s do amazing game breaking stuff on skill checks when they shouldn't, that's not the rules as written, it's not as rules as intended either, then you should have an equal one for nat ones, because that evens out the game. There is a lot of positives that stand on the side of the player and not quite so many on the side of the GM, which is why the GM breaks the rules, in my opinion, a little bit more often.
Yeah.
But I think that comes down to each table. That's a discussion to have. And our discussion was that we don't have those kind of fuck-ups on low levels. I tried to make it clear when like, hey, this is what your character thinks, but it's not the choice. It's not real. Just because then you as a player get to decide whether you want to use that information or not.
Yeah. I'm a stickler for heroes. If I'm playing a hero, I don't want to drop my sword every 20 of that deck. but I definitely, like, if I sit down session zero and the DM's like, oh, ones are drops, I'd be like, can we stop that around level 7? Like, I feel that once I'm shooting lightnings out of my fingertips, yeah, I shouldn't be dropping my knife. Like,
Yeah, it feels. I'm on board with that. Yeah, 100%. I think that's a very good compromise.
Let's pick up a moment where our characters aren't like fuck ups anymore.
We have to have that hero level when we're like, all right, this isn't acceptable. We're not one shot kills to goblins anymore. So, yeah. Not do this.
You will never see Aragorn or Gimli drop their weapon because they hit the shield wrong. Like,
yeah, that's not going to happen. At certain levels, you are heroes, so you should not be doing that. But yeah, I think that's a fairly reasonable compromise, I guess.
I'm not just thinking if there's an easy way to make a roll 20 whenever you click the perception investigation insight button to roll only to the DM so that the players don't
I don't know, and I don't think that's a thing. I know that you can roll specifically only to GMs or to whatever it is, but I don't think that's a thing.
Yeah, but now I'm just considering if I were to run a game and this is something I would want to hide. So I really want to run a horror game. And this is one of the things that I would just tell people session zero, like, I'm sorry, I will sometimes lie to you because the point of a horror game is to be unsure, to not be 100% at all points.
Yeah, like, unreliable narration stuff. I think playing horror games, if your team is up for it, then go ahead. The only real difference is that when you don't do those things, is that you just have to be a little smarter about what you're willing to do.
Well, that ain't something I'm capable of, so.
Or in certain cases, talk so fast nobody knows which of the ones you're saying are lies and which one of the things are to be believed, and build up trust. There's ticks, like, especially if you're intending to have characters be like moles or working for the other side or actually just be the big bad that's always around them, you have to build up that trust with them first, and that can backfire. Can have the, oh shit, I do an aura reading and they're lying. I'm like, I can't have you around my character. GTFO. You just have to be smarter with it.
It's magic, man. It's always magic that fucks you.
Yes.
There's a reason why dungeons aren't towers. argument. Like, it's a lot harder to cheese dungeons.
Yes. So I was kind of glad that we didn't have magic. Kind of. He's kind of magic, kind of not magic with Laffian. If he can't be counterspelled, he also can't counterspell. So I guess magic can truly fuck this team. So I had that. I always had the, like, I don't have to explain my magic away. I don't have to explain how this is working because nobody really has the chops to deal with it. And no one's going to cast magic breaking stuff that will absolutely destroy me. Yes, there are psionics, and yes, they are kind of like magic, but not. But even then, I can deal with it. It's fine. I never have to explain, what magical school does this come from? I don't know, guys.
I was going to say, that is legitimately my biggest pet peeve when DMing. It's the, you see a faint magical aura around a cabinet. Oh, what school is it? And I'm like, I don't know. I know what spell this is, is being held here. I don't know the fucking school, buddy.
Yep.
I...
And does it make a difference? It only narrows down a bunch of spells. Maybe it doesn't. So maybe I'll just tell you that this kind of thing, it holds some sort of fiery magic. Nailed it. That's because I just suck at those particular things.
There are two schools that you want to know. It's illusion and evocation, which is the damage spell.
Right,
group.
Okay, yeah.
Those are the only two people need to know. Otherwise, it becomes so nebulous what the effect might possibly be. Oh, it's
necromantic energy. Yeah.
Like, a necromantic energy is coming from the cabin.
Alteration? And what's the other one? Conjuration. Where did this come from? What is in it? Is it in it, or is it the thing? All right, cool.
Yeah, it becomes so nebulous that the only two you really need to know is illusion and evocation.
Anyway, that was the whole magic BS. I'm sorry.
Yeah. No problem. We'll definitely get back on the magic train at some point. We need to talk about how easy life would have been if they just had a wizard or a sorceress or a druid.
Well, no, because the magic at this level is quite low and very limited. I think at this point they're only level 2, maybe level 3. They're a very low level at this point. So magic access at that point is still very, very low. And the damaging cantrips are no worse or no better than stabbing things with daggers, I think, all in all. So, low levels, magic isn't a massive detriment, I don't think.
Yeah.
It wouldn't have helped them a lot.
So in the story, back to the story, There's not a lot left of it. It was a pretty simple but like straightforward episode. They get the truth key from the graving, the painting.
Yep.
And it has like, I genuinely recommend going back and listening to this episode just because of how on point Casey is. Because Casey grabs their long sword, their great sword,
yep,
and starts poking it through the illusionary wall. And then eventually you ask, how long is your sword? And Casey just goes like, I don't know. It's a sword. It's big. It's great. And you say something like 4'3" or 5'2" or something like that.
Yeah,
and Casey just goes, it's longer than me. They sound so hurt. They sound so genuinely like bothered by this. Like, what? How could you? I would never walk around with a sword bigger than me.
I remember that. That was that's a bloody funny.
Yeah, but yeah, they poke their sword into the wall and the key falls out. They grab the key and they present the keys to the guardian.
Yep.
And at that point, the guardian steps aside, I think.
I think the guardian takes the keys and then steps aside, I think. And then they get ready to enter the next area.
Now, you have admitted this before. You do not have stats for the guardian or Klaus at this point.
No. I went back through my notes. I don't have... Let me check. So I have my notes, like, because I say they were quite intense, so I knew. This is a large skeleton, 10 feet tall, and a 6-foot tall undead bear. Yep, that's it.
Okay.
His master is Savaras. He is awake because Savaras is not. That's the notes I have. Yeah, that's it. That's the whole notes I have for Klaus and Guardian.
Okay, that kills a lot of questions I just thought of. Cool.
Well, that's the thing, especially like here at this point, and I still do it now because I remember prep better and I work better if I've done my prep like maybe an hour or two before we play. And at this point, I was always up to the line. Sometimes I've done prep like months ahead in advance just because they're big plot points and I'm thinking about them. But the minutia usually comes down to like, you know, within an hour of playtime or something like that. I did that recently where I wrote a bunch of notes and I was ready to go and then recording got delayed and then it came back 2 weeks and I fucked everything up. So I don't know how to deal with this anymore. But at this point, it was written down and I had in my mind, there is a skeleton, there is an undead bear. The undead bear is called Claws. They will activate when they get pissed off, annoyed, if they have all the keys or about to get all their keys, you know, stuff like that. So a lot of this notes that I have down there are just reminding me of the notes that I had mentally prepared before we'd started playing. So my notes are definitely not good enough to be used as modules or interactions for stuff like, how does this trap work? I don't know. They just remind me of the trap that I was going to have. It's like shorthand. If I write out a paragraph and exactly how the picture frame worked, I would go insane trying to read it in the middle of talking, because I'd throw myself off. You can hear it whenever I write actual dialogue, I get thrown off reading it versus just improvising around it. So a lot of these just serve as reminders. That's kind of all that's really on there. But the thing is, looking back at this, I now very much remember what was going on in my brain when I was doing this. So I might have the answers, they're just not written down.
All right, then I guess the real first question I have is, who was the guardian thousands of years ago?
I don't know.
Yeah, okay. That was not in your head.
Yeah, I didn't know. I just wanted there to be a 10-foot skeleton king and he was going to be from Savaras. Like, that's
had you decided if he was a druid and that's why he had a bear? Or what, did he have a bear just because you wanted there to be a zombie bear?
I decided he was going to be a ranger.
Ranger, not druid. Sorry.
Yeah.
All right. We actually did skip past one note I have before we sign out.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is the first time the age of the Dragonborns is brought up. The fact that they are quite a young race.
Possibly, yeah. Because I knew that the Skeleton King had come from Savaras 5,000 years ago when they had put this together, when the gods had pulled this place apart and when the elves and the dwarves and all the other races had like built this area. Not that I knew at the time of writing that the dwarves had built the area. But no, I decided that this was from then, so he would not recognize Ral at all. Like, there'd be no way he'd recognize a completely new race. This might be the very first time, I think.
I'm pretty sure we've gone into it a little bit. You decided that the Dragonborns were a young race because you didn't want them on the island?
Didn't want to play with them. I decided that the Dragonborn were going, like, their entire... because I've seen Neil come to me and said, hey, I want to play Dragonborn. I'm like, all right, then I guess I'll have to properly flesh out their story rather than, yep, they fight against Marnak and Kells to make sure that they aren't total douchebags when they come back after they're reassigned. Great, perfect, moving on with my life. There's a dragon there because we have to have at least one dragon in this world. Fuck it. Mm-hmm. And then Neil was like, hey, I want to be a Dragonborn. I'm like, shit, I need to write stuff. So yeah, that's kind of why there is more Dragonborn information out there. But yeah, like that they're on that island because I didn't want to, and I think I mentioned this before, I kind of suck at this whole lore Wizards of the Coast thing. I don't know much about it. I still don't know. I fuck a lot of shit up because I don't know, haven't read it, and I probably won't ever. So for me, I'm like, all right, this is what the Dragonborn lore is. Yeah. So this is why these people wouldn't know shit.
You hit a strange button with me when it comes to your treatment of the lore, and it's my particular way of thinking that kind of like bumps against yours in this mm-hmm. case. And it is the I'm going to take something mostly fleshed out, something that I know vaguely about, and I'm going to take it and change it slightly so it fits my world. And I'm like, yes, please do. I love this. I love when people take stuff and make it their own. The problem that I have is I never know where your knowledge of the thing ends and where your like improvisation starts, or where your knowledge of the thing didn't end, but you decided to improv around it because you didn't want to deal with whatever that was. Mm-hmm. So in the case of the three tier, the three gods, it's a tier, the god of suffering.
Oh, Tyr, Ilmater, and Torm.
Yeah, Tyr, Ilmater, and Torm. Thank you. I almost said Ilmater, but I thought it was wrong. The fact that they three are kind of conjoined into a triad, I think, is Wizards of the Coast stuff.
Yep, it is 100%. And that came about solely because... I think I mentioned this before. Damaz and Demi are an insert from a former campaign that ended... Shit, it was really bad. And me and Thirsty were really into those characters and we had a lot of fun with them. And I'm like, all right, I'm going to give them some sort of an out. So we'll insert characters loosely based around them. Demi was never at all organized or in charge of anything. She was not a good teacher and she always stayed one inch behind her brother just to piss him off. Vastly changed. So Damaz was a paladin of Torm. And that's why he's a paladin of Torm now. I'm like, okay, I'm going to bring that in. And then we have like, I can keep that triad together. And then Casey sent a message like, I want to be part of Tyr. I'm like, this is even better. Yes, I can keep that triad together. So I can keep that as a thing in here. And then when I was talking with Thirsty, when we were chatting, I asked for his help on, all right, now I'm actually killing off more than one god. And this seems to be going somewhere. What order do you think we should kill gods off in? And we sat down and chatted about it. And eventually we settled that, you know, at some point, the god of self-sacrifice needs to die. Like that just has to be a thing, and that's of the three that can't happen soon in the line of like in the order of assassination, because that's a really big god to take on very, very, very early, and Kells and co may not necessarily have that power, so that has to be a later on thing. So I know quite a lot about the triad because I did a lot of research on them. I also did a fair amount of research on Grimsh's role in that too. And I was like, nah, this is bollocks. So I changed a lot of that. I understand it. I understand, especially from those of you who know the D&D like monster manual pretty well, or creature manual or lore manuals very well. For example, I know vampires are such a bone of contention. Of what the Wizards of Coast say that these should be and what the stat blocks say this should be, what I think vampires are supposed to be. So you'll quite often note that when I come across creatures that are based on other ones, I don't necessarily say their name. Because I can't. I try not to mention that the Beholder was a Beholder, like Gazer. It's a smaller version of a Beholder. It does this, that, and the other. But it allowed me to fuck with certain things. And it also, if you don't know any D&D at all, you're not suddenly like, what the hell is a Beholder? What does that look like? Because it forces me to describe it. So I try and avoid using names when possible. And if you decide this is a Demogorgon, then you've decided this is a Demogorgon, my friend. But just note that's probably what it might be called in our world, but that's that may not be true. Yeah. Like, its particulars may be slightly different. Classic monsters, like, and I'm talking vampires, things that are in, like, the world lore, like, our world lore, like vampires and werewolves and shite. I don't mess with them too much beyond the preconceptions because you should be able to kill... what are they called? Werewolves with silver, and it should only be the three nights of the full moon. Like, no, don't transform in the middle of that. I'm not messing with that shit.
Oh, yeah. No, like, and this is exactly what I'm talking about. Like, you've painted a pretty easy picture for me to, like, kind of grab onto. It is that. It is the, like, oh, to me, werewolves are vulnerable to silver. And D&D is like, no. Werewolves are also vulnerable to silver and all magic.
Yeah.
It's basically just immune to normal weapons. And it's, you're like, I don't know what the fuck that means to me, but...
Yeah.
So you just move on, and it leaves, in this case, where there is real-world lore, Wizard of the Coast lore, mm-hmm. and now V-lore. It leaves you with a little bit of a, like, I have to kind of pick and choose, and I have to listen to V, and I have to try to figure out where V has decided to cut the Wizard of the Coast and cut the real world to make their own. The problem comes when you have things that are inherently... Wizard of Coast, like completely and utterly made by them.
Also, I could fuck with it if I don't tell you what it is. And it also kind of, to me, at least helps that, to me, at least, it helps that meta balance that players mm-hmm. have to do. Like, I know all about this creature, and I could hear you getting more and more annoyed because you'd forget out what this creature was. And I'm like, this is great. But you then didn't have to bounce around the information that you know because you know that I fuck with it. Yeah.
All right. And I think that's a perfectly fine way to place to end it off.
See, I
for
don't
this
know
record.
If it is because I have some other things.
Oh, shoot!
I make reference to that because he talks. Laffin tries to taste the potion and figure out what it is, mm-hmm. and this was a very new thing to me. I'm like, this is a thing in D&D. Yeah, sure, great. Sounds like a thing in D&D. Sure, fuck it, go for it. Sounds legit. I'm all over it. And then I was trying to describe the taste of it, and I think I described it as when you accidentally put salt in your cereal, and that had happened to me a couple of weeks before this recording, which is why I'd remembered it. And listening back to this episode, I'm like, yeah, now I remember why I said that. That was gross. It was a lot of salt, and it was really grim.
How much sugar do you put on your cereal?
Well, I was like, oh, this sugar's a bit fine and normal. I'll just put a little bit more in.
Oh, did I get powdered sugar?
Yeah, kind of. It was my dumb fault. I was really tired. I usually am in the morning. So yeah, there was that. I mentioned at this point that the being held here has many names. He doesn't mm-hmm. know them exactly because that was the intent. Each artifact has a different name associated it in a different language. All of Kelsey's does too. And I wanted the Guardian to drop that piece of information as we're going forward. So if they were looking around like, why doesn't it say Shadeslayer on all of these things? Because everybody's language is different and beautiful. Beautiful-ish. And claws. I'm going to talk about claws.
Okay. Please. So, regale me.
The origin of claws. Claws OG. So I used to run a post-apocalypse game with my buddies back in the UK, and there were 9 of us that played regularly, which was fun, a nightmare, and we did it for an entire year, and it was amazing. The finale was set in an underground station, subway for y'all Americans out there. And they went into a thing, and they went in there, and they found this room, and this room had these kind of strange alien creatures in it, and then they continued on with the rest of their stuff. That became the lamp in a fantasy setting. I changed the story massively, but the layouts in my brain of the lamp and of that underground station are 100% identical. You walk into this big room, you walk in a corridor, you turn right or you turn left. On the left hand, straight ahead of you, there is like this big ass room, and it's filled with cages, and it has the alien creatures in it. In this case, in the fantasy world, in the lamp, which I've run a lot, there are cages and there are owlbears in them. And I love pretending to be an owlbear. I love that physicality because I used to run the lamp a lot in the real world. And obviously the subway game that I played was also in the real world. And I love doing those motions. I love like leaning over the table and roaring at people. Like I do the whole fucking thing. So that's why claws is here, because I had run the lamp recently and I really love doing that stupid shit. That's why claws is in this game, solely because of a game which wasn't even in the same setting that became slightly D&D, and I'm like, oh, I can't put an owlbear in there, that's too obvious right now, I'll just make it a bear.
So you say that, but I do believe that you have painted yourself into a very sad corner.
Why?
I think I made a joke about it very early on in the game. Oh, why not an owlbear? And you said you haven't earned the owlbear.
Yes.
And it is now far too late to give us an owlbear.
Is it?
Yeah, they're like chance rating 6 and we're level 15.
Well, who says you have to fight the owlbear? I was trying to kill everything in my world.
If you put an owlbear in front of me, I'm killing it because of my preconceived notion as a player that owlbears are the most ferocious and angry magical being out there, second only to the beholder, but the beholder at least has an intelligence.
Yeah, the owlbear that I inserted into the fantasy game, into the lamp, has a mama bear. So as soon as you find baby owlbear, which most people end up calling Hoots or Hootsie or something like that, and it's adorable, as soon as they interact with the baby bear, that's it, mama bear comes up and that's actually the threat. So yeah, they are vicious dicks. But you could try and fight a cute baby owlbear if you want to, Aethel. That's entirely up to you.
I will kill anything you put in my path. I don't trust you anymore. You put a spoon on the floor and I'm gonna detect evil on that shit.
Oh right, okay, I'm writing into my notes, owlbear. Like, I have to somehow bring this up. So that was claws. And the statue that is in the fountain, I believe it is.
The three people.
That's right.
Sorry, yeah, I skipped over that because you kind of like explained the god.
Kind of answered it, yeah.
My brain kind of like, yeah. Sorry, yeah. So in the opening hall, there was a fountain. You had a statue of a female elf and a slain dwarf, but you also had three people just kind of standing together.
Yeah.
The description was one is a fighter, one is tall and wearing a cloak, their face mostly hidden, and one is a female elf.
Yep. So I had a short, fighty male dude who is Tempest. There is a tall, cloaked person, and that is Miracle. And then you have the serene-looking elven woman, which is Sylvanas in our world.
Whose face can only be described as serene. That's the phrase you use.
Yes, I wanted there to be so originally looking through it, I'm like, oh, I'm going to look through all this stuff and I'm going to figure out like which gods make sense in this. And obviously I came across like Tempest and I thought that makes sense. I come across Miracle. Yeah, that makes perfect sense. And then I come across Sylvanas and that makes perfect sense. And I was like, I can't have three dudes do this. And Savras, who is also a dude. Fuck this. I need some women in my life. I love me women.
Female representation.
No, I just love me women. Like, you look at a dude, I'm like, yeah. I look at women, I'm like, fuck yeah. So I need some more women in my life. So I decided that Sylvanas was going to become female, and that was an option for them. If, however, throughout the game, like, end up being that they entrap more with them and, you know, someone brought up the male thing, they could be either. It's their choice. But at this point, I think I had already decided that Miracle was a deity of death and not a god or a goddess. Because yeah. I was like, I think I mentioned this quite a bit. Death, I think, in my opinion, is non-binary. Like, I don't think it should matter.
I don't know. It seems to come after us dudes pretty harshly, so...
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
We're doing dumb shit inviting the danger home, but...
Yeah, I mean, I personally really love the idea that if women bring you into this world, women should take you out. And I think that, like, gender... And I don't know where I read that. I don't know where I read that death should be a woman. And I'm so annoyed because I can't find the source of it. But I really like that idea. However, as I was developing this, like, whole story and working on the original triad, working on, like, the four gods who actually responded for breaking apart those, I was like, I can't have this. I can't have this like mix of stuff. I think I have to take away from what I think, and I think I need to make like Miracle non-binary. I think I need to make them an MB. So that's where they became what they are. I think I do a good job at staying with it. We will tell when we hit episode 9. We'll find out when we listen.
All right. Do you have any other notes?
Only that everybody going off in their own direction at the same time was a nightmare.
Oh, I thought that would have been a boon because then you didn't have to worry about all three of them touching the same thing at the same time.
Yeah, but it's just a pain in the dick. Splitting the party is never great as a GM because you're trying to figure out who the fuck to focus on and in what order, even if they do happen all at the same time. No, it was fine. We figured it out. We had everything together. I think that's it for me, I think.
All right. Then I'll just, I guess, jump into the outro. Thank you, everybody, for listening to episode 8. Episode 9 should come out in about a month's time, depending on our schedules allowing. If not...
soon.
Sorry, it will come out soon.
TM, soon.
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 If you enjoyed Beyond the Eclipse, consider becoming a patron. We have patron goals for more Beyond the Eclipse, and eventually they will become monthly if we hit high enough numbers to excuse it. Excuse it? What's the word I'm looking for?
So every, I think, 10, 15 or 20 patrons, we're going to do another set of Beyond the Eclipse, which are two episodes. So that's kind of the plan for that. And at some point when we think the amount of patrons, the amount of Beyond the Eclipse is ridiculous, then we'll probably just keep doing it.
Yeah.
At least until I'm like, I genuinely have enough of this like weirdness. This is so strange to me. But y'all seem to enjoy it, ? So go ahead. And also, if you have any like specific questions for episode 9 or for episode 10, shoot a message to Aethel. You can do it on Twitter. You can do it on the Discord. You can email us at theluckydivepodcast.com. You can do all of those cool things. So if we get to a good amount, then we'll probably keep doing this until I'm like, I can't do this anymore. I'm losing my mind.
Feel free to send me the message anywhere you can, or even into the email, theluckydiepodcast@gmail.com. I'll sort it out and grab it myself. If you want to listen to more TLD stuff, we have a YouTube, we have a Libsyn, we have all the good things. You can listen to all of it everywhere. I don't think there's anything really else to shout out. So I don't think so.
I think that's mostly it. Just go listen to some cool shows and leave reviews for them. Not just us, but everyone. It helps everyone. Go ahead, do it, please.
Next episode will probably be post-Christmas, so I guess it's just happy holidays and have a fantastic week and month.
Yep. Bye.
Bye.
Greetings, adventurers. Today we're excited to introduce you to a new story, Dark Dice, a horror podcast that blurs the line between actual play and audio drama, where the story is determined by the roll of the dice. Six adventurers embark on a journey into the ruinous domain of the Nameless God. They will never be the same again. One of the players is not what they seem after a doppelganger, a creature that can assume the form and voice of whatever it kills, infiltrates the team. As the players are picked off and replaced one at a time, can they figure out who the monster is before it's too late? Can you? Here's a quick example of what our show sounds like.
The shambler with the jar of liquid inside of him.
Soren Arkwright let loose an arrow that cracked the glass, passing through the spine of the creature. The shambler still managed to maintain its forward momentum, but stumbled as it eagerly tried to bite and swipe at Soren, landing near his feet.
As Jeff Goldblum has now joined our cast, Dark Dice is available however you listen to podcasts.